Well, good evening and welcome to this first presentation in this, our 13th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries, with additional support for this program from Fleur de Lis Press and the Gender and Women's Studies program at WKU. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at Western, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, Hai Wong Wan. Ryan Dowell and Patrick Peters designed our posters. Our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauly. Jonathan Jeffrey arranged for us to use the Western Room tonight. It's my very great pleasure now to welcome the former Poet Laureate of Kentucky, Zena Naslund, to introduce our speaker. Zena?
Thank you so much, Brian. It's lovely to be here with you and to get to introduce to you Jane Olmsted and her new book, Seeking the Other Side, a Collection of Poems. I've known Jane for a very long time. Our mothers were friends in Louisville, Kentucky. And I knew that Jane was going to be a wonderful person because when her mother moved in next door to me and my mother, baby grand piano moved in with them. Now, anybody who has that kind of piano has a soul, and so does her daughter. This was my assumption. So Jane was in Bowling Green, Ohio at the time, but she came down to see her mother, and we got acquainted over playing Monopoly. She's a ruthless Monopoly player, I remember. But more importantly, Jane was interested in writing at that time as an undergraduate, and she came to the University of Louisville to study in the MA in writing program there, where you could do a creative thesis. And I was on the faculty there teaching all kinds of writing, although I'm mainly a fiction writer myself. From the very get-go, it was a privilege to have Jane in any class because she always responded to the fellow writers from the heart and from the head. She always wanted to offer encouragement. She always wanted to be honest, and that to me is the bedrock of good teaching, and it's the way we need to relate to people. So she was very good as a student critic and a student writer, and I always knew she would go on and on to write because she was full of ideas. She paid attention to technique, but more importantly, or at least as important, were the ideas in the piece as well. Where was its humanity? Where was the beating heart of the idea? All of that was important to Jane. Well, we started a literary magazine at the University of Louisville called the Louisville Review, and Jane was the second editor of that magazine. This press, Fleur de Lis Press, is a late child of the Louisville Review magazine. We've been having the press for about 10 years or so now. It's one of the most joyful things I've ever been associated with, both the magazine and the press. It is wonderful to look at people's work, say, I love that, and maybe I can make it possible for other people to know this famous, wonderful, should be famous writer at the same time. Actually, as far as fame is concerned, at the Louisville Review, we were concerned with the quality of the work, and we actually turned down a lot of famous writers who thought they were going to get in the Louisville Review, as well as publishing a lot of people for the first time. One of those people was Louise Erdrich, who was a student at Johns Hopkins at the time. Another was a man named Alberto Rios, who was a student at the University, Arizona State University, wrote a poem, My Abuelo, My Grandfather, and that poem is anthologized now in National Anthologies, the very poem that was in the Louisville Review. So we trusted our good sense about what good writing was, and we tried to be welcoming, and it was a wonderful thing to do back then and still to continue to do right now. To me, my own writing and teaching and editing are all one big happy ball of wax. So I'm especially happy to be able to tell you a little bit about Jane's book. I don't want to say too much about it because I want her to introduce it to you in the way that seems suitable for us. She'll tell you how it's divided into parts. I do want to say something about the title and the cover, Seeking the Other Side. And the painter who did the cover is with us. It's Yvonne Pekus, right back there. So thank you, Yvonne. And Yvonne has a series of paintings about women emerging, women dissolving, women seeking like this. And in the back of Jane's book, there's a little essay or page or two that Jane has written about Yvonne's work. And, you know, that is so typical, reaching out. Who else is there who's creative, who wants to help you, who wants to be part of the fold? And I love that I'm an old friend of Jane's. Jane is an old friend of Yvonne's. And this is not a closed circle. You know, arms are open to all of you in what we're trying to do. I admire these poems of Jane so much. I love every one of them. And every one of them has that quality that I spoke of having a certain technical originality that brings you to look at something that's fundamental and human in the realm of thought and feeling that you wouldn't have been able to approach from any other angle. These poems are full of surprises. I wouldn't say that they're easy poems. Things that are highly original are often not easy, that sometimes you need to listen or to read again. And then suddenly a whole world is open to you, a whole world of thought and feeling in these poems. Some of the other people who have praised her work include the poet Frank Steele, and I especially liked one of the things he said, and that is the questioning here, Frank Steele wrote, of the self, of the culture, takes place at a white-hot intensity that makes the emotional displays of the old confessional poets look tame by comparison. And that is really true. There is a degree of penetrant truth in these poems that make that sort of confessional material seem lightweight in comparison. Georgella Lyon, the current poet laureate of Kentucky, says of the poems that they're electric with love and grief. Another wonderful phrase. And Tom Hunley, who many of you know, says, born out of heartbreak, these are ultimately poems that celebrate, savor, and affirm life. So, Jane, it's just about your time to come up and enjoy your wonderful poems and sharing your words with so many friends and friends of poetry here. Thank you all for having me down. It's lovely to be on your campus. And I'll just remind you again that after the reading, there is a book signing and a sale of the books. And also, Jane has a gift for each of you. Maybe she'll tell you about that. Please make Jane feel happy.
I'm almost getting a little misty-eyed hearing those comments. Thank you for reading those, Sina. And thank you, as everybody else has said, thank you to all of you who made this possible. Sina, Brian, my sister artists, Yvonne and Mary Ellen. Yvonne for her gorgeous painting. And I'll always remember that conversation at Spencer's when we talked about what the poems meant and what the painting that you do means, and finding so much overlap. And Mary Ellen for her gorgeous, my first review. Thank you for that. The Creative Writing Program and Gender and Women's Studies, of course. When Brian was prompting me about tonight, he said that people want to hear about what it means to be a poet, and he said they like to know about the craft and the practice of poetry. So I'm going to weave a little of that in. For me, I think poetry asks us to crystallize an idea or an emotion or an event, to narrow the expression of it so intently that anything else that's not relevant to it is gone. Doing this, I think, requires that poets be honest. They need to go deeply within. They need to look in the eye whatever it is that's confronting them. I don't do this myself nearly as often as I'd like to, and I think our best poets do it brilliantly. But in this collection, I've tried to bring to bear as honestly as I can what the mysterious mind says we should be looking at. I call this poem Seeking the Other Side because I wanted to honor that capacity of reaching across boundaries to connect in some way with the other. And it's not just reaching, the seeking suggests an intentionality about it that I wanted to try to capture. The other side may be the line between life and death. It could be the line between the self and the other. It can also just be the line between one part of the self and another, the shy self and the social self, or the self before and after some cataclysmic event. So those are just my first thoughts that I wanted to share about what poetry has meant and means to me as a writer of poems. The book is organized into three sections. The first one I call Ways of Touching, and it was actually the last section to get finalized. And I think I have three poems I wanted to read from this section. So I guess I did want to say one thing. The shape and size of things, I've heard all my life that the heart is the size of a fist. And I wanted to sort of look at that because what could be more different than a fist and a heart? And yet I wanted to look for the commonalities between them. So the size and shape of things. They say that a heart is the size of a fist, and that a blue whale's tongue weighs as much as an elephant. What does that tell us about the elephant or the whale? They are big. They belong in different places. Would the glass remain half full if a fist ripped out the heart and settled into that slippery absence? A fist, gnarled with rage, hungry for love, might think that a ball of flesh and bone could take up residence in this home without causing a stir. How could it know, floundering at the end of an arm, shaking at the skies, sounds, balled against the eyes, burrowing into someone else's flesh, or clutching the pillow from the depth of sleep? I want to whisper to the fist, mention the marrow, the affinity of bone and liquid, then ask, is there room at the inn for me? The second poem is called Far, Far Away in Vilnius. We were in Lithuania for a conference. Ken had a paper accepted at an Alistair MacIntyre conference, and the paper was on Do We Die Alone? Although he had already had the essay accepted before our youngest son was killed, Casey's death lent this essay that he wrote new urgency. It was 9 months after we were crazed, but trying to act normal. So this is a kind of love poem from a very surreal time. While my husband attended his conference, I wandered around the city. It's a beautiful city. It's still probably the most beautiful city that I've ever spent time in. I loved finding the Frank Zappa statue. They have a place called the Republic of Uzupis, which was created in his honor, and it has a constitution that validates caring for cats and the right to cry. And so that, what a discovery, as I was crying. But at the same time, I couldn't understand why I was there. What was I doing there? And I had this notion that my son was might try to reach me, and his spirit, and that I could not be found because I was across the ocean. Far, far away in Vilnius. A paper boat and an empty carton of juice dangled from a bridge over the river. Why, you asked, did someone do that? I said, two children were playing in the water with boats they had made, and afterward they hung them out to dry. Then, in the river, we saw a stack of shapely rocks, then another, then many. They looked dribbled from the sky, dabbles of brown paint. Why are the rocks piled just so, you asked? Why? In the city of churches, I said, pagans come to the water, gripping the slick stones with their toes, then hoisting them high. And not only that, I say, here in the side streets of Vilnius, doorways too small to step through unless you're an elf or a child or an old couple stooped over. I miss my home, I tell you, which is why I'm sad. Is it a big missing, you ask? No, it's a little one, like a notch on one of these padlocks attached to this bridge by people in love. We lift and turn them, and they settle with a clink above the water. And then I ask if you have a lock for us, knowing you don't. How could you? Are just discovering them like that on the way to someplace else. And finally, from this section, this is actually my most recent poem. It's called Whisper. Last night I dreamed my boys were fighting. That was long ago, and yet they are 10 or 11 again, and one of them has hit or twisted some part of the other's body so that he is curved into the wall. A blade, sudden as a ray of light, cuts heart deep, and my own voice rushes at me from across the room. I can't do this anymore. They disappear, the boys. It's the alone that tells you no one is coming, walls and ceiling receding fast. What is it that you can't do anymore? Stand by watching, hands dangling, or cupped and asking to be filled? I reach across the rocking floor, seeking what it is that holds me here. My dog's soft ears, her warm scent of a cared-for animal, the sweat that leaves gray trails behind my child's knees. Yes, these are the things I'll miss. And you, what will you miss? Tell me. I'm in no hurry, and I'm learning to listen underneath when someone says it doesn't matter and all is well. The middle section is called Tree Forms. They were inspired by trees that I encountered in the Rocky Mountains when I took a solo camping trip out west. I was healing from a fairly wretched work-related experience, and it turns out it was about a month before Casey died. I began to feel while I was there that the trees were somehow speaking to me and that they had a story to tell that I needed to hear. Sometimes the poems speak from the persona of a tree that I imagine, and sometimes I let the trees inspire me. This first one is called Camping on Gray's River. It was inspired by the sort of usually four scratches on the aspen trees. These scratches were all over the place, and they were made by bears. And I have actually two bear poems. I think bears are pretty awesome creatures. They are sort of this blending of the wild. If you have them in your dreams, I think it's a very kind of, they're kind of a spirit kind of visitation. So, Camping on Gray's River, Bridger Tetons. Why do they do it, scratching the aspens this way? I feel them watching from the sunlit copse as my fingers trace their four vertical scars, more animal than others, dangerous if fed. That night it was cold. The river current paused a moment, opened a pocket of silence in the rushing conversation with brown stones. I felt the throb of the tent cords when the body assaulted them and heard the shush of fur against nylon. I did not yell, go, but curled around the vital organs and waited for the cuff that would send me spinning through the zippered door, even lifted my face to the frosty air and sought its hot, hungry breath stinking of rot and musk and dark. Why the dream of rushing into terror, as though I welcomed a final, this is it, wanted to expose my belly, surrender myself to the other self. And this last poem was inspired by a slender tree that had fallen across a very beautiful lake at the very near the very top of the mountain. And it was bleached of all color and went from one side of the lake to the other. And so I imagined myself as that tree. Or this is a persona poem, speaking in the voice of that poem. When I fall, I'd like it to be in a very clear lake at the top of a mountain. I'd like to know that I will see the mounting fuzziness and of moss and beneath the hard calcium of other elements, that fish dart beneath me in the sun and above the brilliant stars pulse in harmony. I'd like to fall with a splash and ripples that hit the shores and come back to me saying, yes, it's there. When I fall, I'd like to know it's near home, that my roots, even exposed, are familiar, if not exactly what they were before. Make it green with a hint of blue, and me, bleached of all color, just a path, narrow and tentative for some tiny creature seeking the other side. I'm going to stop playing with my hair. That always drives me nuts. People are doing stuff with their hair the whole time. I may make other promises as we go. All right, so these were two trees. They were bare, nothing gorgeous about them. One was leaning this way, one was leaning this way, one was twisted. But they met together and they made an arch. The story they tell is our story. Two trees started green and leaned in slow, took their lifetime to become this arch. They seem an old couple we might know, their lives now stories their bodies tell. Consider the one on the left, see how hid as twisted, reaching for the other until forced away by war or peace, the demands of work, and yet look. See it reach a limb across the divide, though the span is shy, like you, I think, reaching across the space between us. Were the children done then? Was work the way you wanted it, or gone beyond what you had to offer? Why didn't I lean harder then, and when was it clear my slow arch was toward you? Couldn't you have pushed that limb, acknowledged that I, inclining always to the left, was steady as the seasons? It was that second reach, wasn't it, that stripped us down, said this or nothing? It was evident then when first these trees, one smooth and pointed, but how slow, one pocked and twisting, began the spinal dance that ever and a day pulls us in. Love it is then, and all that baggage we strip away. There's always a story, theirs or ours, I hear you say. Take me as I am, love, bare and bristly, you have only and always been. And there are four narrative poems, and I'm going to read two of them. This is the first one. It's called Cyan. Though we will never meet, I have come to love a man named Houchins, the one who tried to bring our youngest back. Because the business of dying must travel from desk to desk, it takes 2 months for his report to reach us. I see him in the act, hunched over a clipboard beneath the red screaming of the ambulance as it tore through the night. For 5 pages, his hand is firm and the print is dark, no smudges or broken nibs despite the hills and potholes. And yet his phrases are foreign road signs in familiar terrain, pupils fixed, BVM employed, ETCO2, the sound of air escaping lungs above the siren, IOIV, swelling chest, NSS, and the young man's skin giving over to cyan as the flush of blood withdrew. Outside, the winter landscape is uncertain about the strip of blue on the horizon. Gray presses down, washing out the tones that allow us to get away with calling it blue, even when it has weakened to a memory. The night we read the report, I dreamt they laid our boy on a table and left me alone to study his face. The returning pink that didn't belong, the tear that escaped his eye and rolled down his cheek. I helped him sit and strained to understand the language already turned against him, words knocking in his throat like tumbling boulders and his urgency a rushing flood. I spoke the only levy I knew to slow him down. How I loved you, loved, each word a sandbag. He hesitated, did you? And then understanding broke across his brow. I know you did. The memory of his arm still cresting my shoulders, I lift the curtains and note the flush of morning and the black arms of the oak, each one capped with white and muffling what happens when one world gives way to the other. Can you hear me? When you lose somebody over time, I think what happens is, over the months and years, it's a series of discovery. There's always some new discovery. And this is a poem about a necklace that I found and had forgotten. It was beads on a string that spelled, "Forgot about me." It also tries to grapple with one of the most crippling emotions, which is guilt. Imperative. One, you came home from a church retreat where kids make crosses out of bamboo strips or paper plate masks, wind socks or bookmarks, but this time a necklace of beads, black and white on a red string. Don't forget about me. Were you rephrasing Christ's requests or spelling out a sweet indictment, the imperative about yourself and not God's Son? In all the fol-de-rol of work and life, not now, go play, stop hanging on me. Still, I never forgot. Two, what were you thinking the night you died, driving to a place so clearly marked by fear and degradation and rushing toward the lowest circles of hell? If you had known of its hidden arsenal of guns and compound bows, flak jackets, MREs, and sawed-off shotguns stacked so thick the detectives could barely move, would you have hesitated? What were you thinking when you pulled away? Did you roll down your window to shout one last invective? Did he burst out of the house like a cowboy through swinging barroom doors, or slink like Rambo around the auto graveyard that circled that shack like a noose? Three. I hold a grape and close my fingers until the skin retracts and the slippery globe falls quivering into my hand. Slender veins encircle it and thread all through. My palm is wet with sweetness, the thick casing still between my fingers. I prod the perfect sphere into its vulnerable hole where a stem once gave the sack shape. Do I have it right, your imperative? Or were you lamenting a deed already done? Forgot about me. Madmen seek no proof of beauty, but cower in the darkness of their shredded hearts and scrape their shadows across the way, enduring their suspended sentence, perhaps even since they were children, their sunken voices garbling, "Have you forgotten me?" By the way, at the time I wrote, this was a very early poem after it, and I thought that the man who did this must be mad, that he was a madman, that he was a cretin. And that kind of changed after time went on. I mean, there is a kind of madness in what happened, there's no question. But I don't know that he was a madman as in the way that I thought he was at first. This is the second of the two narrative poems I'd like to read. It's kind of an homage to Henry Reed, who wrote a poem that you all poetry lovers might know. It's called The Naming of Parts, and which is only in a very superstitious way about naming the parts of a rifle. Hydrostatic shock. Today we are putting the pieces together. Yesterday we had the news. Tomorrow and tomorrow we'll have the ever-crashing waves. But today we learn about calipers and hydrostatic shock. A 40 caliber does what 22s fail to do. Faster and more penetrating, 22s pass through, leaving the enemy alive. A 40 caliber lopes along and flattens a little when meeting something hard, like bone. Dreamed of in 1990 by the highly successful arms developers,
Smith & Wesson, the .40 caliber travels 1,000 feet or so per second. You can't see that kind of velocity, but you can wonder at how quickly it slows, knowing that shoulder to farthest rib in a young man is only a matter of inches. Compared to manlier missiles, the .40 was laughable, dubbed short and wimpy and slow and weak. Yet the .40 caliber gains caliber, gains penetration, and gives up only speed. Once it takes its Sunday stroll through soft tissue, pressures develop. They measure these in thousands of atmospheres, which feels about right, and categorize them in threes, like the Big Bang, linear. First, sharp pulses where the surface is struck, then whole regions to the front and sides of the moving missile, and third, low, maybe quieter changes in the cavity behind it. Experts disagree, but this appears plausible. Some shock won't kill, but in liquid-filled tissue such as lungs and heart, destruction reaches far beyond the path of the rimless straight casing and its 32,000 pounds, give or take, per square inch. One man likes it because penetration crushes more tissue, bone, and hopefully an artery, while this one dispenses with hope, less energy, more momentum, bigger hole. We find it interesting that .40 caliber paintballs fit any .40 caliber logo. Tomorrow we may want to learn more, but today we know enough. How a nanosecond can hold a swirling cosmos of befores and durings and afters, and how their ballistics got one thing right. There is a cavity involved. Our son struggled with addiction, and from about the ages of 11 to 20, he moved in and out of destructive and healing places. He had some very dear principles. One of them was honesty, and another was being true and loyal. So this is my attempt to sort of plow through in an honest way through some of the challenges that he faced in terms of darkness and light, and also the challenges that that brought to his mother. Things that are hot and cold. And so it's kind of a comparison, moves back and forth between hot things and cold things, is how it's set up. Things that are hot and cold. The way you used to blow, one day a sulking cobra, the next a ray lifting the hooded eye and a smile easing the wariest of hearts. Fingers stiffening around a cigarette as December flattens the flame of a candle I've placed on the patio railing. Your forehead, where I pressed my lips, your purpled lips and eyelids fastened shut, the room where we stood holding hands and your father cried, "Sweet Jesus, what have they done to you?" Emptiness, what you knew of death on earth, fear when you saw a demon snarling in the mirror and crack, the underworld came boiling to the surface, stumbling from the room in hopes that ignoring you as you screamed in my face how much you hated me would prove to you that love endures. Your low voice mumbling, "Love you," the spill of blood sluicing between organs, my fingers when the cigarette goes out. A form poem called a ghazal, I think that's how you pronounce it, it's in couplets. Its theme was always love and the pain of love, but the beauty of love despite that pain. I also wanted to say that I had always been told by my creative writing teachers that you should never use abstract words too much, that we want concrete, you know, show me, don't tell me. And I was kind of obsessed by an abstract word, the word life, and so I decided I wanted to disobey that rule and use the word life as often as I could. So a ghazal is in couplets, paired words, and it ends, every couplet ends with the word life. Ghazal by a thread. Love is a thread that will not break, though in this gray life it surely must, bearing as it does so much, yours, theirs, my life. Last night I walked a star-crazed night, then sat on the old swing until the bare branches glittered, Morse coding a splintered life. In utter stillness sometimes I hear a whispering, things not living, spirits piercing the plane that separates us, though not you, silent from life. So new to their world, are you seeking a way through some breach? I search the edge of every odd-shaped thing, scrap of life, and ask, what on earth is the matter? What does it mean to be the thing that ended next to you? What difference are you to your own life? The silhouette I've made for myself, chalking up scorn for this or that, is blurring and the lines redrawing. It seems the life I've called my own is but an echo of someone else, someone who can only be heard or found if she lets go of that life, sloughing off the skin and bearing the rawness, pulling hand over hand and gathering the lines of this deep, shadowed life. Okay, so now for the hard one. It's not that hard, just kidding. The last poem in the book is in seven parts. I call it The Requiem of the Bristlecone Pine at Lake Hayaha. A word about the title. Hayaha, I learned, is indigenous word meaning rock. And Lake Hayaha is a rock at the very top of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. It is gorgeous. It is surrounded by huge boulders as big as this room, and half the size of this room, splattered around this lake. And there on the rocks, I found this bristlecone pine. The bristlecone pine is a spectacular tree. It's the oldest living creature on Earth. Some of them are 5,000 years old, which is, for me, very hard to even think about or imagine what that means. I knew, or I thought from the beginning, that this was going to be my family tree poem. And then I realized after Casey died that it would be his poem. I also wanted to pay tribute to Brahms' Requiem, which is a sacred piece of music that's very beautiful. And I listened to it every day for a year or a year and a half. And so it was my companion for that first year. It was finished in 1867. Just a couple of items about the Requiem. Rather than a traditional Requiem that follows Latin, he followed the Lutheran Bible. His Requiem does not ever mention Jesus Christ, but focuses instead on general themes of comfort and hope. Brahms said in a letter that he would gladly have called it a human Requiem. So all this spoke to me very much as someone who loves sacred music but is not a Christian. So if you will bear with me, I just want to say a word or two about the structure of the Requiem, which I use for the poem, okay? So it's in seven parts. It's very balanced, the way he's structured it. So part one and part seven begin with the word blessed. Part one also uses the word precious seed, which I pick up on. On the notion of the rock, the Hayaha rock, with the idea of that tenacity for life that comes with a living thing starting its life on a rock. At the opposite end, that's one over here on seven, is the also begins with blessed, and this movement for me. To me, this is the most beautiful movement. A lot of times people say that the fourth movement is the most beautiful. This one is, to me, belongs to the tenors. And I always, when I listened to it, heard the angels singing. I heard Casey's brothers. So I literally made this human requiem my own as I listened to it. So one and seven begin with blessed. Two and six are maybe the most dramatic, longer. Part two is very slow. It begins with a march-like music. And for me, I was thinking of the march, and I was thinking about soldiers, so I use soldiers to kind of allude to that. P-word, precious fruit, early rain, withered grass. Over here, moving up, that was 2-6. This is the most dramatic section. It's got the phrase, death wears thy sting. And so it was sort of the victory of life over death. Keywords, we shall not all sleep, trumpet, evokes great mystery. There's a phrase in there, the dead shall be raised, and I took that idea of mystery and gave it to spirits, which I imagine arising from an ancient graveyard and then latching onto passers-by who drive by the site where Casey was killed. So you recognize that. I hope you're bearing with me. I know this sounds like I'm talking about this for. Moving on up the arch, 3 and 5, okay? 3 begins with a baritone. The theme is about frailty and vanity. Paired with that, then, is the 5th one, which is the female voice. It was the last movement that Brahms added. He was very close to his mother. It is really about motherly comfort. The way I wanted to deal with the vanity that was mentioned in the 3rd part was, and also the idea of torment, which comes up as a keyword, was to bring in, I thought, what is the most vain kind of male thing or allusion that I can make, and I came up with Prometheus and Zeus. And so you'll hear them in here. There's a story that's alluded to. Prometheus sees people making an offering to the gods. He calls them over and separates the sacrifice into 2 parts. He places the meat of the burned animal in one hide, but covers it with the most worthless parts of the animal. And in the other side, he puts bones, but covers it with some very enticing fat. And Zeus, when he comes over, goes for the worthless bag because he's enticed by the fat that's hiding, the fact that these are just bones. So the idea of tricking Zeus seemed pretty vain to me. So finally, the middle part is the most excerpted. Many think it's the most beautiful. House is the central metaphor, and it is also the notion of the flesh crying out. So those, I've always thought of those 1 and 7, 2 and 6, 3 and 5, and 4 as forming a kind of an arch. And I think of it as kind of a portal that you enter through. And this might be a portal, you know, from the specific to the universal, or between life and death, or between sorrow and joy. Requiem of the Bristlecone Pine at Lake Hiaha. 1. Blessed, it is said, are those who mourn. What began in perfect symmetry and fell from the sky on this rock has left parity for the innocent. When did the twist of pale green, so succulent you could have drunk it, begin to twist and ache into itself? Perhaps immediately, when it thrust out an elbow from its seedy casing and rose to see what world it had entered, finding walls of rock that wanted surfaces to tell their own story only. I see the brown seed cap rise above Chaos Creek, burst there as well, sweet Pinus aristata seeking the familiar, unprepared for the wind that took its breath away. Gasping, it would have dropped to its knees, would have thrust its limbs out, would have grasped at anything, even the sharp edge of pale lichen. 2. Leaves have fallen during the night, and rain comes over the hill, waking then rocking me back to gray. I hear the footsteps of soldiers marching. I run to them and pull their faces to mine. My hands read their cheekbones. Have you seen him? Is he with you? Their skin is soft beneath the grimy stains of filth and tears. They will not be slowed. Blind and deaf to distant gunfire, they carry what they think they'll need and leave nothing to mark their passing but this clump of withered grass. My fingers curl around the dried edges and linger here, where a bud once showed its face, and there, where a root once sought its depth. 3. I run it through my fingers, this one gray strand that will not stay among its kind. I bequeath my body, the memory of you. We'll begin with the place I carried you, here, a round tot bowl, dense with the fiber of your silences. All you could not bear by yourself, we'll place in here. I'll watch the mass grow large with all that's left to be said or done. My arms will swell and twist with the effort of lifting you from the wreckage and carrying you home those long miles. They will cry out as Atlas did and bring these knees to the ground. They will crack the rock that still says no, but they will not hear no. Here, my back becomes my side, my front. There is no dividing me anymore. I reach for you until the winds have turned me full, and then it is I who turn the winds. Here is a cavity that closes nightly and wrenches open again by day. Prometheus, cousin, what fat bundled bones might trick Zeus now? My ears grow large for the sound of footsteps across the landing, but learn instead the disappointing scrabblings of mice and the sleep-talking woodbeams that hold it in by day and groan the full night of all that is not well, of shouts and threats and tears. This is the haunting of wood. 4. On a crisp morning when I was alone, the mist rose like a penitent's delivery. The shaft of sunlight may have only been a shaft of sunlight, and the voices of angels may not have risen. Someone said we should not project our feeling natures onto animal, vegetable, and mineral worlds and endow them with more than they can bear, but I think we are not so distinct. The deeper meanings of love direct our feet, and our feet say, we will take you there. The most honest of creatures, a tree reaches for the root of things and for the merest hint of light. The bristlecone pine asks to tell its story, not just the skin nor only the form of it, but the holes and densest bowls, whorls and scars, the piney fingers, especially these, poised in the act of flinging a clump of needles, something so like the beginnings of joy. 5. Resting in this pocket of time, I open the spiral-ringed notebook where you mixed history and math and wrote your heart. What if the prodigal son stayed proud? A son drifted into himself and found death on earth, emptiness. How did he return to life, humbling himself? The pencil nub thickens and the words pale and stretch into each other, so I have to hold the pages to the light. I haven't been doing many things positive, and I don't see things positively. I don't see things like other people. I just don't see. Virginia Woolf wrote palimpsest to protect from hungry eyes. You would have liked the idea of writing over writing, her vulnerability and her clever texts. Writing seems to help, and I don't really share it. Not really shy, but don't want to offend anyone. I can write a lot and get most of it out, but I'm not sure what it is. I stack the pages and study the palimpsest of words and crisscross lines that rise where you scraped the sharpened point across your scars. It might be just a little right now, but I feel a lot better. Starting to think more positively and not get upset so easily. It's not good to read what was written in secret unless it's aloe you divine, some truth you've ignored or overlooked to lay across the damaged place. 4. On the night he shoots and kills you, the semiotics, Maddox, blunt nose, extends his face and finger and its open nostril flares. Loud retorts echo from his craven heart, and the whistling paths that sting the air thicken into threads of rope. Four spent casings cry out as they hit the ground as though emerging from a mouth. 3 shots slam into the tree beyond where bark and fiber splinter, sending a shock through the entire system, down into the hairy tips of roots that caress a waiting burial ground and wakens spirits who rise, rise, rise. Some circle the place while others grab hold of passing cars. Their tears are ancient, and the dreams they entered carry a new taste of rot that will grow familiar and large with hunger. He thought you were his for the taking, and those of us whose boy you really were are swallowed by the cavern of the sky, dream of falling and wake to the shuddering of our bodies. On such a night, one comes to me, rolling out a carpet of crumbling leaves and dirt. A breath is laid across my lips like a finger. Love and blessing trumpet through me. Your broad shoulders curve over me, and then you mouth the words you loved. Choose life. 7. Blessed, it is said, are the dead. Already your torments have lost their sting, and your good works follow you. We speak of being better people and set our timid feet upon the ground. I begin to see that when peace enters, its super will not pervade, that nothing will stay the loss of you except you in your new form, moving and yet still. I pull you close the way I always pulled you close, and note again the sweetness and despair that made you wise beyond your years. We gave and took, you and I, and evermore I fill my hands and lift them to you. Drink, then let us go. I just would like to thank you all for bearing with me through that. I know it's hot in here, and I appreciate your attention.
I'm sure you'll agree it was quite an extraordinary evening. It's been extraordinary just reading the poems. I've been reading, savoring them a few each night, and it's been an experience for me. A little token of our appreciation, Jane, for such a wonderful evening. Thank you so much. We'll now move, if you'd like, to obtain a copy of the book. I think Jay thought we'd make them available at special price, $15 and $12 if you're a student, and Jane will be moving out to the table to get a sign. Thank you so much for coming.